At the conclusion of the service last week, when I announced the subject of my address this morning, Ways Which Lead to Divorce, someone approached me in the hall and said, Rabbi, can you tell me of one nice, quiet, inexpensive way? And I was reminded of the story that is told of the old man, the very old man who came to the rabbi in a little town in Eastern Europe years ago and said, Rabbi, I'd like to get a divorce. And the rabbi looked at him and said, Yankel, at your age, you must be meshuggah. You have one foot in the grave. What do you want, a divorce? He said, Rabbi, to tell you the truth, I wanted a divorce right along from the very first year we were married. What he said, by the time I got around to it, there was the first child born. Well, you don't divorce your wife after the first child is born, so I waited. I waited, the second child, the third child, and so it went on. By the time I got ready, he said, the first child was bar mitzvah. Well, he said, you don't divorce your wife when your first child is bar mitzvah. So I waited. The second child, the third child was bar mitzvah, and I waited. And before I got around to it, the first child was ready to be married. Well, he said, you don't get a divorce when your child is being married. And so he said, it went on for years. I waited. And then the first grandchild was born. Rabbi, this is really the first time that I'm free and I want a divorce. So the rabbi said to him, Yankel, he said, go home. You really don't want a divorce. You just want to live in great expectations. And I understand what people say, that you're expecting to become a great grandfather soon. I will not speak to you this morning of the evils of divorce or of the alarming and rapidly rising divorce rate in our country. They're all too well known, although very little indeed is being done about it. One half of all the divorces reported in the world each year are granted in the United States. For 1,000 married couples, the rate of divorce in the United States was 10.4, in Canada 1.7, and in England 2.8. The number of divorces in any given year ranges between 1/4 and 1/3 of the total number of marriages consummated that year in the United States. And in some localities, the number equals actually 1/2 or more. Now, it does not require great imagination to realize how homes which have been disrupted by divorce or annulment or separation or desertion, that is to say, homes which have become no homes, affect the lives of the children, in many cases the lives of the adults involved. And how the spiritual health of a nation and the stability of our social life and institutions are endangered by this mounting number of broken families. I venture to say that the major disease of American life today, the major spiritual disease, is divorce. A degenerative disease which attacks the vitality of a people and always leads to domestic decadence and to the undermining of a civilization. When the number of divorces keeps steadily and rapidly rising, it is a symptom of a widespread restlessness and discontent which is spreading among a people, and of a alarming shattering of moral disciplines. And this is a danger signal of an approaching disintegration of the social order. And no society can afford to ignore these danger signals. But I wish to speak this morning not of the growth of divorce in our country, which is apparent to all, nor of the grounds for divorce, which differ so sharply from state to state in our union, thus causing much confusion and seriously bedeviling the situation. But I wish to speak this morning of the causes for divorce, of some of the sad and in many instances avoidable ways which lead to it. It is true that the American family is subjected to greater strains and tensions now than in the past, but that is really to say that greater demands must now be made on character and on the inner spiritual resources of the individual man and woman who wish to preserve the home and the family. In the last generation, two world wars contributed to the disorganization of family life in our country by uprooting and transplanting millions of men from their normal environments, from their customary ways of life, standards, and disciplines, to camps and to overseas. And divorces always rise sharply after wars. Wars and broken homes are closely related as cause and effect. And the emancipation of women, however desirable that has been, and our growing economic independence as a result of the increasing employment of women in industry, undoubtedly have contributed to the divorce rate. The incidence of divorce is higher among working wives than among housewives. And 7 million mothers in the United States are employed in industry, and 2.5 million of them who have children under 6 years of age. All this has tended to aggravate the problem. And poverty and slums and unemployment and all their attendant evils are also factors. Divorce is more frequent among the poor than among members of the middle class or the rich, although it should not be overlooked that divorces rise during good times and decline during a depression. Divorces are by no means, as we all know, limited to the poor. Economic security is by no means synonymous with family security. But without a reasonable measure of economic security, the resultant strains and stresses endanger the stability of the home and the family. There are, of course, instances of maladjustment among married couples, which are fundamental and quite incurable. And such people are better off divorced. No amount of conciliation by courts or counseling by social agencies or the skill of the psychiatrist will help in such a situation, because there was never any basic union here to keep this marriage going. In such cases, Judaism countenanced divorce, although it deprecated it. But men and women do not always know whether their maladjustments are really fundamental, or whether there exist only sharp differences and misunderstandings which may be resolved, given time and forbearance and the help of a wise counselor or a friendly agency. And every opportunity should therefore be given for reconciliation. And reconciliation agencies should be available in every community. Cooling off periods should be made mandatory. And some states are made mandatory before suits for divorce are filed or granted. Divorces are most frequent in the early years of marriage, before the cement, so to speak, of married life has had a chance to unite young people firmly into an enduring life companionship. Now, of course, many explanations have been given. I indicated some can be given for the rising rate in broken homes. But of course, an explanation is not a solution. These explanations simply point up the fact that it is more difficult today to preserve a sound family life than in the past, and that greater demands are therefore to be made upon those, or to be made by themselves upon themselves, upon those who enter marriage and who wish to preserve it. Now, one of the factors which frequently contributes to divorce is the initial failure to anticipate. The initial failure to anticipate these difficult adjustments to which I have referred, which are quite inevitable in all marriages, and which must be faced and surmounted as a prime condition to a successful marriage. But marriages have been glamorized to a point where some people expect that the marriage ceremony itself is a sort of an insurance policy that they will live happily ever after. But the marriage ceremony is no guarantee of happiness. It is a solemn compact of mutual commitments. It invokes divine sanction and blessing upon new and grave responsibilities which the young man and woman in love are willing to assume, responsibilities to build a home, to raise a family, to help one another, to pass from the ecstasy of romantic love to a steady, abiding love and devotion which will sustain and nurture them throughout their days. Young men and women bring to their marriage not only their hopes for the future, but also their pasts. Each comes from a different home, a different background, different schooling, a different upbringing. Both have their individual likes and dislikes, their traits and opinions. At 18, 20, or 25, men and women are pretty well set in their ways, their habits, and their attitudes. Up to the time of their marriage, they have gone their several ways. Now they must go one way. Now there is but one home which they must build out of the material of the homes in which they grew up, and out of their independent experiences. They must become emotionally weaned from all sorts of mother complexes and father complexes. They must become, as the Bible says, basar echad, one body. And that is not easy. And for some it may be extremely difficult. But a very prime condition of marriage is to make every effort to do just that, to face up to whatever the difficulty may be and the friction and the tension which might flow from it in an adult and mature way, not as if one has been suddenly overtaken by some unexpected and unpardonable surprise, and not to permit it to lead to rupture and separation. Americans are the youngest married people in the world. And I'm afraid that many immature young people rush into marriage with their heads filled with the phony, fictional notions of romantic love gleaned from radio and television and modern trash literature, so that their marriage is wrecked on the very first disillusionment, on initial disappointments at not finding in their mates that perfection which they expected, a perfection which really does not exist anywhere in the world. And they come to grief as a result of their first serious troubles and cares and anxieties, which inevitably are a part of every human life. Failure to anticipate difficulties is one of the ways which lead to divorce. And another way which leads to divorce is what I might call excessive individualism. There are those who enter marriage in the thought and hope of fulfilling themselves. Marriage, they believe, will help them get whatever it is they want out of life. But the goal of true marriage is family, and its focus should not be myself, but ourselves. Now, we need not and should not sacrifice our personalities, but we must surrender our individualistic propensities, our self-centeredness, our chief concern with self, and in so doing, we are enriching ourselves. We grow into greater compass. We become not less, but more. We become finer men and women. There are those who expect so much from their mate, so much love, so much attention, so much consideration, but give so little themselves. At times, this attitude is quite unconscious, and the offending mate is quite unaware of it. And when the man is confronted with such an indictment, he will be inclined to exclaim, "Who, me? Why, I slave all day to give her everything she wants. I wear myself down to the bone to surround her with comfort and luxury and security." Which is maybe true, very true. But is that all that she really wants and needs? What of the amenities of life? What of companionship? What of the little courtesies and attentions? What of drawing her into the mainstream of one's life's interests? And when the woman is confronted with a similar indictment, she too will be inclined to exclaim, "Who, me? Why, I keep house for him and look well after the children. And in my spare time, I take part in worthwhile community activities." All of which is maybe true, very true. But is that all he really wants and needs? What of taking greater interest in him as a person and nourishing his pride as husband and father in the home? What of cushioning adversity for him? What of building up instead of tearing down his morale? Not living for each other sensitively and on all levels is one of the ways which lead to divorce. "Marriage is something you have to give your whole mind to," wrote Henry Gibson. Marriage is something you have to give your whole mind to. In marriage, my dear friends, the heart must never remain unemployed. There must be unfailing solicitude and a looking up, one to the other, always, though not necessarily for the same reason, but a looking up. Never a looking down. Men and women often drift apart, quite unconsciously, because their worlds of major interests become closed to one another. Closed to one another. They begin to move in different orbits, though physically they are still living in the same home. They become alienated not because of their dislike for one another, but because they have become each absorbed in interests which are unrelated to home and family, and they are centering their lives elsewhere. I'm not speaking here of marital infidelity, which is a recognized ground for divorce or separation everywhere in the world. But I'm speaking of a developing disharmony among men and women because their lives no longer interpenetrate. They fall apart because the cohesion of common purposes and interests no longer exists. They are alone even when they are together. Age, my friends, brings with it a measure of forbearance and tolerance and patience. But they sometimes come too late. We need them much earlier in life. We need them much earlier in life, especially married life. Often we realize too late that every one of us is many selves rolled into one. And we are not our best self at all times. And wisdom should teach husband and wife to make sure that their bad hours do not coincide, that they do not unleash their temporary bad tempers at the same time. Tempers will flare up. And I'm not counseling meekness and submission either on the part of the husband or the wife at all times in spite of all provocation. But timing, skillful timing, is the key to the occasional domestic groundswell. The weather will clear and the sun will shine again if the one remains calm while the other is in storm. And boredom is another way which leads to divorce. Divorce, as you well know, is not limited to the first few years of married life. Frequently older people are divorced, people who have grown children. And no one single explanation will cover all such cases. But boredom is surely one of them. There are men and women who are not prepared for the slow years, when the freshness and luster and excitement of the early companionship have faded. I think it was George Bernard Shaw who said that the greatest sacrifice in marriage is the sacrifice of the adventurous attitudes towards life, the being settled. Some men and women, become so settled in routine, in ordinariness, in commonplacedness, they go so terribly slack that the tedium of life overtakes them. Husband and wife become weary of themselves and of each other. Their union becomes insupportable. They fly apart in disgust of themselves and of each other. They have grown tired and have become tiresome one to another. This is true particularly of some married men and women in the upper and middle classes, the comfortable classes. All the material needs of life are provided. The women have all their work done for them. Time hangs heavy on their hands. They come to suspect that their existence is somehow formless and purposeless. They become filled with ennui. They become restless. Or if one or the other keeps alive intellectual and cultural interest and refuses to grow stodgy with the years, and the other does not, then an emotional barrier is set up. One of scorn, perhaps, of resentment, which is fatal to the dignity of both. People are by nature nomads, and when they are bored, they will set out to find new oases. And I suspect that many married couples are not sufficiently alerted to the danger of boredom, into which they drift quite unconsciously. It is possible to avoid it. Unflagging interest in home, in children, and in their children, filling each hour with worthwhile activity, learning and improving oneself constantly until the very last day of one's life, setting up, as it were, intellectual antennae to catch the voices and the music of our great exciting world, making our home a place to which stimulating friends love to come. There are many ways by means of which we can not only banish boredom, but keep our minds and spirits young, keep ourselves interested and interesting to one another. The founder of Hasidism, Israel Baal Shem, said one day to his disciples, commenting on a verse from the Bible that God renews his world every day. God renews his world every day. Israel Baal Shem said to his disciples, unless we believe that God renews the work of creation every day, our prayers and the doing of the commandments grow old, accustomed, and tedious. It is written in the Psalms, cast me not off in the time of old age. That is to say, do not let my world grow old. I would say to all married people, do not let your world grow old. Renew your days as of old. And finally, dear friends, there is another way which leads to divorce. The way which bypasses the synagogue, the temple, religion. The way which bypasses the religious practices and customs and traditions of Judaism in the home, the way that bypasses God. Men and women are not strong enough to solve all their problems by themselves. Religion can help. In the ethics of Judaism and in our way of life, there is distilled the wisdom of many generations. And one should be guided by that wisdom and not rely solely upon his own understanding. Judaism has declared marriage to be sacred. It is God and not a justice of the peace who unites in marriage. And God hates divorce. As the prophet Malachi said, Ki sanei shalach amar Adonai Elohei Yisrael, I hate divorce, says the Lord, the God of Israel. And he who divorces the wife of his youth, declared the famous Rabbi Elazar, even the altar of God in the temple, sheds tears over him. We have become terribly lax in our religious disciplines, so that the thou shalt and thou shalt not of religion, which are intended to uphold men and women in their trials and to help them in the making of the important decisions of their lives, they are no longer of any help to them. I'd like to do it, but I must not, because it is against the law of God, is no longer a deterrent for many people. Now, a home in which the presence of God is felt will, as a rule, stand firm. The observance of the beautiful and meaningful customs and ceremonies of our faith in our home will strengthen its foundation. Children will treasure the memory of their mother, kindling the Sabbath lights far more than the memory of their mother smoking a packet of cigarettes. I commented to a friend not so long ago upon entering the home of a mutual friend how lovely it was to find a mezuzah attached to the door, the traditional symbol of a Jewish home. He did not think so. It's an old superstition. A few weeks later, I visited his own home, and there over the mantelpiece I found displayed a solid iron horseshoe. That was all right. I recently read an address which my dear friend Judge Samuel Silbert of our own city delivered some years ago before the Cleveland Bar Association, in which this beloved jurist, who has faced more troubled couples seeking divorce and has studied the problem perhaps more profoundly than anyone in this part of our country, said, we should help to eliminate the material and the crass and help inculcate the spiritual qualities into marriage. Let us do our share in aiding to keep marriage as a sanctified, holy relation of lifelong duration by adding dignity and solemnity to it. There are ways which lead away from divorce, towards the deep satisfactions of happy married life. Entering marriage deliberately, not hastily. Following a period of courtship, during which the young people become really acquainted with each other and with each other's family. For no marriage is an island unto itself, and no marriage can thrive in isolation. Entering marriage when one is able, however modestly, to support a wife and to maintain a home. There are exceptions, of course, but then there must be, these people must be exceptional people. Sometimes a young wife and husband will both work and contribute to the family budget. That is good, as long as it does not take the mother away from the young children too much of the time. Children should not be raised by one's cooks or maids or babysitters. A periodic checkup of the children by the mother is not enough. Children need the constant security of their mother's presence, her love, and her attention. And mothers, for their own emotional stability and peace of heart, require this very attention which they give to their children. Entering marriage with a certain expectation that it will have its ups and downs, its problems of adjustment, and that it will offer challenges to the moral stamina and character integrity which the young people will have to meet. Entering marriage with a clear resolve to bring to it a full and loyal partnership without reservations. If you want to lead your own life, don't get married. It's the privilege of everyone to want to live his own life, but if that's what he wants, he ought not to involve another life through marriage. The first consideration in married life is home and family and children. And those who make it the first consideration find that as a result, their own lives grow in depth, in meaning, and in outlook. Entering marriage life with a determination always to keep ourselves interesting to one another, young in mind, and never to permit the lyric, beauty, splendor of our early years to fade away into the humdrum of the advancing years. And finally, entering married life with a prayer in our hearts that God will always be a guest in our home, that the beauty of holiness will dwell therein. And then though the earth does change and the mountains shake and the waters roar and foam, our home will stand secure, for God is our refuge and our strength, a very present help in time of trouble.